Welcome to the latest United We Stand podcast. My name's Andy Mitten and I'm delighted to welcome our guest today, Graham Hunter. Graham is a football journalist, spends most of his time in Barcelona and travelling around Europe watching European football. He works for a number of people, including UEFA, including Sky, and he's also written his first book a couple of years ago, Barca, the Making of the Greatest Team in the World, which was chosen as the Football Book of the Year at the British Sports Book Awards in 2013. He spent most of this year writing a book on the Spanish national side. And I'm actually calling Graham from Barcelona, but Graham is in Manchester. Although he's not from Manchester, he's from Aberdeen originally. Is that right?
Spot on, that's one hell of an intro. You should do this for a living, that's pretty groovy.
You're an Aberdeen fan?
Oh, born and bred, you know that very well. Dedicated. One of my earliest football memories would be queuing up on the corner at, say, Trinity Hall in Aberdeen to welcome back the 1970 Scottish Hockey team, captained by Martin Buchan. Manchester United legend and all around good guy. And from that day to this, Aberdeen is the only team that matters to me in terms of making my pulse race very fast. And even though you live far away, my dedication to going back doesn't quite match yours with United, but you only ever have one team, and the Dandies are still the ones for me, as you well know.
Martin Buchan, who still lives in Manchester, he's a great fellow, Martin. We'll get him on the podcast. He's agreed to it in the future. He said when he left Aberdeen for Old Trafford in the early 70s, he couldn't believe how bad the standard was at Old Trafford in comparison with Pittodrie. So that shows then how good Scottish football was. And, of course, as an Aberdeen fan, it got even better for you because there was a fella called Ferguson who didn't do a bad job for you.
Well, look, I mean, I think you've done a nice job in setting up what Alec came into, in that Aberdeen has been well run. We were very lucky to have the type of people that Alec went on to meet again at Old Trafford. We had a man called Dick Donald, who's the chairman, who Charlotte has gone on to detail how important as a club leader, but also as a father figure, he was from, and I suspect that if you were to sit him down and ask him now how much he learned from Dick Donald, he'd say an enormous amount. And then at Aberdeen, there was a man called Chris Anderson, who was visionary, and I think made us the first all-seated, all-covered stadium in football stadium in Britain. Began to open up ideas about marketing, went to America, studied American sport, brought these ideas back to the country, which seems bizarre now that we are limping along without getting proper crowds, not sure where to play our football. And that meant that over the years, although we weren't a dominant force, Aberdeen continuously won cups or would beat members of the old firm and give you enjoyment and bought good players, scouted particularly well, somehow managed to take great players from Glasgow when Willie Miller and Jim Leighton out of the course should have been picked up by the old firm without any question. And that's the side that Sir Alex Ferguson joined from St Mirren. When Billy McNeil had been with us for a season, and the season that ended really disappointingly, second in both cup finals, second in the league, and at the end of the season, with his promising manager, Billy McNeil, still very, very new in his work, having only managed quite before us. I remember having been at Hampden to lose 2-1 to Rangers, and you come back to Pittodrie, and in those days, getting to a cup final and losing gallantly meant that, you know, Pittodrie Stadium was, although it was free entry, was full the next day of fans saying, you know, well done, lads. And I took the microphone and said, I'm off. I'm really sorry. You know, except it's a cover of my heart. It's where I won the European Cup in 67 and they need me. And I'm really, really sorry, but I'm going. And at that stage, Andy, that seemed, if not disastrous, very wounding. And little did we know that the club were ahead of the curve. I had already spoken to Fergie and brought him in. He moved into Quarry Road in Colts, next door to my best friend, Graham Runcie. His kids went to the same school as me. And life changed. Life didn't just change in terms of his footballing achievements. And I suspect everybody listening to the United We Stand podcast knows this. I know you do, that when you've got a Fergie in your life, it does change your life, not just your team's results. And for somebody young and growing up, in that neighbourhood of Colts and going to Pittodrie every possible excuse and beginning to travel to away games, you you see an attitude towards life. You see an attitude towards how far away your horizon should be. There should be nothing that's, you know, hemming you in when you follow a Ferguson team, when you watch a Ferguson team, when you learn from his statements, from his attitudes. And I did. I soaked up some of that and thought, well, if it's good enough for him, I'm going to apply it to my life, for my choices. And that did me no harm in you know, my subsequent years.
What was it your highlight as an Aberdeen fan before you became a journalist?
It would be hard to define because, again, as you know very well, I'm pretty quirky and eccentric, and it should obviously be beating Real Madrid in Gothenburg, but I remember the feeling when we began to regularly beat Celtic and Rangers. I remember how, you know, there were real thorn in our side clubs when Alec was manager, particularly Partick Thistle under Bertie Auld. Morton side. Anybody asked Alec Ferguson now about which side over his entire career has given him the most bizarre trouble, it's probably Morton. Excuse me. Just the very memory of them. I don't know if I swallowed a fly or what.
Or maybe it's just the mention the mention of Morton.
It probably is. If I remember rightly, they had a Rooney up front as well. They had a guy up front who was an absolute phenomenal football player, Andy Ritchie. And, finally, when we would knock Morton out of a cup competition after humiliating draws and defeats and whatever, I remember that joy almost as strongly as when the Cup Winners' Cup was lifted. I remember the sheer joy. People forget about Aberdeen under Alex Ferguson beating Hamburg in the European Super Cup. And again, to beat the European champions was phenomenal. But possibly the night where it felt that it all came together for me most of all was from a losing position at home to a very good Bayern Munich side at Petodri, going out initially 1-1 on the goals and then 2-1 trailing, still going out 2-2 and away goals and winning finally 3-2 when you consider his Man United career. There were themes which haven't changed that much about how confident his teams were, how robust they were, how many times they would win games late on, the degree to which the football was always on the front foot, a game was never lost. Over my time reporting with Manchester United, to the extent that when I was reporting the Cup Winner in 1999, from a newspaper, when the final was won and Alec lifted the European Cup, I could only see, which is true emotion, but I could only see the Aberdeen manager lifting the European Cup. That's all it meant to me at that time, which is crazy, but I think it tells you about the amount of influence that man can have on your life, even peripherally.
Pierre Van Hooijdonk was one of the guests on our podcast last week. He's a decent character. Tell me a little story about him, because I believe when you first became a journalist, the arrival of Van Hooijdonk in Scotland got you a little break.
Well, yeah, the story's more complex than that. You are right that I stormed into the newspaper offices that were open there for the Daily Mail. It's a complete new start, and I'd given them my CV a couple of weeks before, and I was outraged that they hadn't got back. I didn't know the way of the journalistic world at that stage. And I was in the middle of saying to the editor, you know, I can't believe you haven't got back to me. And he was sort of saying, who are you?
How old were you?
Get out. That's a very good question, but we're talking about, Andy, thanks for this, somewhere around 2004, 2005. And Manchester United come into this story too, if I'm not wrong. And effectively, literally, I was being hoisted out of the building when old-style, old-fashioned journalist, someone came running in the door to the editor and said, there's a press conference been called at Parkhead and we don't have a reporter because it was a new start, complete new start operation. The one football reporter had been sent to Petodri to prepare for what everybody thought was going to be the sacking of Willie Miller. And the guy who'd been hoisting me out the door said, look, can you handle this and not screw this up? And I was like, yeah, you bet your life, buddy, don't worry, I'm on it. So they dispatched me, and they gave me this one chance, dispatched me in a taxi at the Parkhead. I walked in, there was a crowd of ugly knuckle-dragging growlers, the Scottish press in one corner of the room at Parkhead, and a bright, noisy, interesting bunch of about six or seven others who turned out to be the Dutch contingent, and kind of nobody in the Scottish contingent was interested in me or talked to me or even showed me the courtesy of a good morning. I went and talked to the Dutch, who said, listen, don't worry, you haven't missed anything and you won't be hearing anything from Van Oudon for quite some time, because he was playing cards with his Natbeira teammates last night to, what do you say in Spanish, saying despedirse, to say goodbye to them. It went on far too late. He missed his plane. He's pretending to the club, and his agents pretending to the club that they were fog bound, and he's had to catch the next plane, and he ain't going to be here for quite some considerable time. Celtic duly held the press conference. The word fog bound and delayed plane was bandied about. The Scottish press all accepted it. I went back to the office saying, recently missed his press conference was he's playing cards last night with his mates on until all hours. And they went, well, that's a great little twist on it. It's a good story. Have you got that to yourself? Yeah, I definitely have. Back page hold, the back page splash. So on my first day, I'd flipped a good story, helped the journalist get a kilt for a beer, got a nice little tail, which was getting me a break, and I had the back page lead until, and I've got to be careful because Dave might trip me up here, I believe that there was a big day on the same day as Van Hooydonk saying for Celtic, and you can research this, that the whole, either Shearer went back to Newcastle and Cole went to United, or Andy Cole went to United. There was a record-breaking deal on that same day, and I got bumped out by that. Something to do with Andy Cole.
It was January 1995, and Andy Cole left Newcastle for Manchester United.
That's it. That's exactly what happened. Because I'd gone in the post. I'd spent whole money in Dublin and fueled up my anger that I hadn't had a reply from the Daily Mail, and that's when I stormed in to say to them what the hell's going on. And it was that same day, later the day after the Van Hooydonk press conference, Cole went to United and bumped me off the lead story this last, and I was irate. Never forgiven Andy, you can tell him that.
I'll speak to him tomorrow, I'll tell him that, he'll probably be busy.
Secret of all good comedy's timing, isn't it?
You've been working very closely and doing a lot of work during the transfer window. Do you think Manchester United and David Moyes will go back in for Ander Herrera?
Look, I think it's feasible, very feasible. There are a number of reasons for it. Like Thiago was, Ander Herrera spans two eras. The era of Sir Alex Ferguson in charge with Jim Lawler, Martin Ferguson, that's when they began to scout this player before the successful game that Athletic had against United in the Europa League. Although his performance wasn't by any means the only good one for Athletic, that helped seal people's ideas. And you know, the length of time you've been in football and journalism, you know how traditional it is that if a player plays against you in print shows, that's a right good chance you'll end up signing him anyway. But they had been aware of him beforehand. He did well then. They followed him subsequently, and his growing problem meant that there was a worrying scouting department at Old Trafford about whether he had the pace to get away, he had the tricks and the technique to get away from tackles in the Premier League, but whether he just had that little spurt of pace was something that they questioned, and the agent told them he's carrying a growing problem. Marcelo Bielsa, the Athletic coach, has them running around mountain tracks and, you know, running until they can't move anymore. And Ander Herrera got a growing operation. I think that one of the things that I'm clear about, having spoken directly on the phone to, you know, very senior decision maker at Old Trafford, is that the manager feels that Ander Herrera is a very apt player for Manchester United in terms of his ability and his ability to handle pressure and his ambition, very apt for the Manchester United squad right now in terms of the players that have, the players who may be in decline due to age, and also because of the way that David Moyes wants to play Manchester United's midfield style, and therefore all the qualities that are needed according to the current manager are United and Ander Herrera. The one thing that's a major difficulty, two things, would be that David Moyes feels that during the last 6-7 months he hasn't had personal eyes on the player enough time to have either his most trusted scouts following the guy directly, or else his own eyes either on a game he can get to personally or watching Sky's Spanish football coverage. And I think that if you take away the controversy of the other deals in the summer and you heard the United manager saying, I'm going to be extremely careful before I break the club record, then nobody would criticise him for that. And the other thing that has been a real barrier but may be something that United are willing to attack again is that Athletic Bilbao can't have a president. I am very unimpressed, very frustrated with and insisted on the buyout clause, the clause of the rescission in the contract, which is like €6 million. My opinion, based on previous experience, although not everybody shares this, that is that if a British club tries to pay that clause, then there will be VAT added, so it will not simply be a €36 million deal. Moreover, this is a guy, Urrutia, who treated two of the club's most phenomenal footballers in modern times, Fernando Llorente and Javi Martinez, really, really badly. I don't want to be cheap in my use of comparisons, but he is becoming the Daniel Levy of Spanish football, and that meant that because it came to the deal very late, it fell away from them when it probably shouldn't. But your principal question was, do you think they'll go back? And the assurance from the people at Manchester United and right up to Monday afternoon to me was that that's a distinct possibility, yes.
I spoke to similar people to you. When Athletic's president came on television, one of the people who was very close to the deal, his daughter was watching on television and said, that man is lying. And she doesn't know anything about football. That was an amateur observation. And I sensed that the truth has not been told by various parties. And it's the deal didn't happen. It ended in confusion, embarrassment, frustration. United fans are very angry, not just because of Ander Herrera, but because of other targets that haven't come off. Thiago Alcantara is one. You know what went on there. How close do you think he was going to Old Trafford?
What I know factually is that the close father, who we both know, and you almost picked for a squad in your team.
That would have been brilliant. What a ringer that would have been. I mean, I've had a few ringers over the years, but a Brazilian World Cup winner.
he's a guy who won the World Cup in 94. He played football with Danny McCarthy up at Celta Vigo and was in a team, I think, that smashed Milan 4-0. He was in teams at Valencia that beat Real Madrid and Barcelona. I'm assuming he was a very good footballer. And when you get a father representing a player, I think we've both got experience of that can have some positives. It can also sometimes be too much for them. The father brought in Pep Guardiola's brother, Pere Guardiola, who's representing Luis Suarez at the moment with all the pros and cons that's brought. And they came and spoke to Ed Woodward about the deal. And it came close enough that the Gerard Alcantara Campbell had been up for the wages that were on offer, but wanted a clause that said, like they've got to Barcelona, if the player doesn't play X much in a year, there's a fixed price. It's a reasonable clause. It's an easy one to say yes to when you are confident about how much the footballer is going to turn out for your team. And effectively, what got in the way was Manchester United were unwilling to go ahead in that clause. There was a difficulty again about how to pay the buyout clause and what VAT was chargeable on that deal. And it was the case that Guardiola, about 3-4 weeks before United really got to the point with Thiago, Guardiola had phoned Thiago directly to say, if you're moving, think of me, think of us, we want you, I want you up by a minute. That went into abeyance for 3-4 weeks, but when things began to slow at Manchester United, Guardiola had convinced his board. It's still a signing that is causing, and you know, scepticism in Bavaria. I think that's probably wrong. I think that Thiago shares a characteristic with Ander Herrera, which is that he, however good he looks in the burst of one or two games when people in Britain watch him, he remains a player in development. He is by no means the finished article compared to where he will get, I think, strongly. And that may have caused United to slow down. And there is another factor. I took a phone call again from somebody working for United manager just to say, would like to know, do you know anything about Thiago as a person? This is a due diligence that every club uses, and it's smart. How is he off the pitch? Does he live well? Does he train well? What kind of character is he? And I said, I think that you've got the optimum. You've got a young, hungry guy who maybe is tiny a little bit arrogant on the pitch, but it's a positive arrogance that can be channeled and directed properly off the pitch. He's a very good pro, comes from a family that has taught him values, and you'll be signing somebody you can count on as United player. But at that time, it was indicated to me that the United manager had slightly different priorities. Those priorities turned out to be Fabregas. I don't think anybody would criticise United for targeting Fabregas. I don't think anybody, well, certainly from my point of view, even though it transpires that United were, what's the phrase? United, certainly Mr. Woodward had his pants taken down by Fabregas's agent or whoever was, and it was Fabregas's agent, encouraging that this deal could happen. But in football, I think unless you, if you target a player and you are sure you want him and you trust people will tell you he will come, then you go all in. You try flat out. And I don't think Manchester United, my opinion is United can't be criticised, Andy, for going all in, for really becoming muscular on the deal. I think if I were a United fan or seemed to get older, I'd be saying I criticise our judgment in reading the situation. And I think those are two distinct things, and I'll be defensive of United as an organisation if people say, well, it was stupid to try for Cesc. If you want to convince he's coming, you're all up your sleeve and you show your muscles, and that's what it did, and it kicked and hit the bar. But there's a vacuum where experience used to be in the departures of not just Alex Ferguson, David Gill, but large numbers, as you know from previous podcasts and previous magazine issues, large numbers of the backroom staff who have contacts who suggest this deal might happen. I've been told my contact says this player is ready to come, watch out for that agent. There's a vast vacuum of experience, certainly, at Old Trafford, and Ed Woodward will cop a lot of flak for that. But I think corporately, anybody above Ed Woodward who said it won't matter that a man who's very good at marketing and sponsorship and who has people queuing up to do deals with him suddenly has gone from shooting fish in a barrel to wrestling with tiger sharks. People above Ed Woodward should have been saying, I wonder if he's equipped to cope, and evidently they didn't.
Ed Woodward has agreed to give United We Stand an interview, and we'll be putting a lot of these points to him. And to be fair, that he's agreed to give us an interview because David Gill ceased to communicate with the supporters. So I'll meet Ed in a couple of weeks. That's certainly the plan. You mentioned some of the backroom staff. We've got an interview in the current issue with Eric Steele, where he's fascinating, the former goalkeeping coach. You were close with Martin Ferguson, who was, aside from being Sir Alex's brother, was a senior Manchester United scout. He moved on in the summer. There wasn't anything written about him moving on. How good was he at his job, and how will he be missed at United? Because the fans don't get to hear anything about what the scouts are like unless something goes wrong. So for a time, if you mention Martin Ferguson's name, people would say, he's the guy who brought us Forlan. Of course, 10 years on, Forlan became one of the best players one of the best strikers in the world for a time. But you know Martin well. What's the score on him?
Look, I think what you're going to miss is assiduous hard work where things are done properly. Where if a game is being scouted, as it used to be, I think, at United's height between McBurn and Martin Ferguson, where teams, particular teams, are analysed brutally well. And, you know, when we talk about the work of a scout, it's often allied to this treacherous, increasingly difficult, increasingly sophisticated transfer market. I don't think that was by any means his only job. I think that every fisherman talks about the size of the fish that got away, as every scout says, well, I spotted him and recommended him. But I think that when I was in Martin's company, I would watch him apply the same criteria as his brother would. And those didn't do Manchester United too much harm over the quarter of a century he was there. I watched him put a high premium on professionalism, skill, technique, will to win when he was looking at players. But above anything else, I think that everybody reaches an absolute peak. And what I noticed before I was friendly with Martin, particularly back around the build-up to the treble-winning season and the treble-winning season itself, I felt you know, when you went to listen to Alex Ferguson prior to European matches, I'd never heard him quite so well briefed, quite so sure in his territory as he became then. And I think that combination of Martin Ferguson and McMahon was extremely powerful for United. I have my own views about the people who were around Martin Ferguson in the United Scouting Department, and I'm unconvinced about some of their choices and the way in which they worked. I say that objectively, not in a pejorative way, but having watched some of them in action, I just think that the modern idiom demands different knowledge, different attitudes, different levels of work, and I'm unconvinced that Manchester United's ability to sign brilliantly has been as good as it should be. And I'm also, it's also my opinion, that there have been one or two many players who have been a little bit short of the quality needed at United who have managed to get through the net. And I wonder whether in the current huge volume of changes that's taking place corporately and in a football sense, I wonder if that's something that maybe needs addressing, Andy.
The manager, the former manager, listened to several voices, Martin being one of them. All of those voices had very different opinions over who was right and who was wrong for Manchester United. All of them will point to their successes and their failures. Jim Lawler, for example, he could say that he was integral with Javier Hernandez. There are other transfers which Manchester United fans look at and think that absolutely stinks, such as the transfer of Bebe. We've got to be careful what we say legally, obviously. It is not an exact science, but when I spoke to Martin in your company, he said one thing he did look for in a player was, can he do it at Liverpool away? And I love that idea that it's all right shining for Borussia Dortmund or for Sporting Lisbon. Can this lad play at Liverpool away? And I think that attitude, that mentality, served Manchester United very well. There's only one problem here. United never play at Anfield away anymore. We keep on losing. So somewhere in the mix, that's been twisted a little bit. But your point remains true. There have been huge changes at United on the field and off the field. How do you think United will do this season?
I'm fearful that there are areas where the squad is creaking. However, what I trust in is the fact that David Moyes, now we've got the transfer market out of the way, proved to Everton to be a very, very good coach. Players lifted their level under him when they understood what he wanted them to do. The team became very difficult to beat. Manchester United patently has, at the moment, oodles of creative talent, pace, a reasonable number of goals. And I would be hopeful that if United can become as difficult to beat, plus our level, because there are better quality players than as Everton was under David Moyes, I think there's good potential there. My honest opinion is that it's a very open field. Experience is a very high premium at the moment, because although Mourinho has run the course, he's come back to a very different Chelsea. Manuel Pellegrini is highly talented, and a very good coach, but this is a very new scenario for him at a club which is very green in its development. You look at Arsenal and you genuinely say that they have problems there that they haven't managed to cope with both on and off the pitch. And Spurs have splurged on a large number of players who will lift their quality. But whether they have two world-class footballers there, which it might take to win the league, I have a doubt. So I think that the frustration for United fans, based on not having taken one or two world-class players in over the transfer market, I think must be augmented by the idea that it's a very open title race. I hope to see David. You asked how will they do. I always try to look corporately as well as at the pitch. It is important that they're true to what they've evidently promised David Moyes, and that he will be given time to grow. So Alex Ferguson was. Moyes was given time to grow at Everton. It's imperative that Manchester United hasn't become a club whereby it's everything right now or forget it, because that wasn't the approach applied to youth development. it wasn't the approach applied to the way in which the club expanded in a European sense, and it will be very, very sore indeed to make sure that David Moyes era doesn't bring the type of, the level of success, the regularity of success which we saw under Sarge first, and that will hurt fans. I fully accept that. But if everything becomes knee-jerk, give me my monosodium glutamate success right now, that's a recipe for disaster.
Jorge Mendes' relationship with Manchester United. Discuss.
No comment. No comment. Go on, then.
We asked our readers on UWS Online, our website, and we've been updating people throughout the summer with what's been going on behind the scenes. We told them that you were coming on, and we invited them to put questions to you. I'm not responsible for a lot of these questions. Some of them are sensible. Some of them you'll cuff me when you next see me. The first one is a sensible one.
Right, leave them out. Leave them out now.
I'll see how we go. Who will be the next big young star in Spain?
Look, it depends how closely your reader or listener watches the Spanish scene, because patently, Inesco, Spain, is developing a genius footballer, just extraordinary football talent, fun in the game, who will lift people's spirits wherever you support. He is just off the scale as far as I'm concerned. Beyond that,
United watch Disco.
When the market was closing on Monday, Disco's agent, an agent who was associated with Disco, told me that he had pushed and pushed and pushed United to sign Disco for €6 million, and they said, not sure he's got the stamina or the physicality.
And there was a question mark about his pace as well. It's all opinion.
It's a difficult job, and I think that what stands out now is that if the player is blossoming and flaring and showing that you're wrong when he's 24, 25, okay, no harm. If the player is blossoming and showing you're wrong 8 months later, then that's not great. So beyond that, I like very much indeed Moreno. The flying wing back at Sevilla. I like watching Rafinha and what Lucinic does for him at Celta, given first team football. He got his first La Liga goal at the weekend. That I'm going to find very interesting indeed. I would have said that Morata at Real Madrid is interesting. Whether he's going to be an absolute superstar or not, I don't know, but he seems to have big time temperament. He has the physique and pace to play wide than the left and then an out centre forward. The guy that we've both seen playing varsity football, for whom I've got high hopes, is Sergi Samper. You always look to see if the mentality and the physical development follows on. And the fullback at varsity as well, Grimaldo, who's had a horrendous injury, but will come again, is somebody who undoubtedly has world class talent. And a guy who I'd like to see getting a break in life rather than a break in his leg is Canales at Valencia. Again, another guy that United tried so hard to get to the extent that I know Sarge Ferguson was willing to jump on a private jet and fly to Santander to convince him and his father United was the right place for him, before which the father of Canales had persuaded him to sign for Real Madrid, which turned out to be a bad move, but nothing to do with the injuries he's suffering at Valencia. That is a class or a Rolls Royce footballer, and he just can't stay fit. And fingers crossed and pray to our maker that he gets 3-4 injury free years and we see a world class footballer develop.
I was going to go down and see him in Valencia, just see how he goes the next few weeks. And he's got good
class, Andy. Top class.
If you were literally a Graham hunter, which Graham would you hunt down first?
That's very interesting and sort of psychedelic. Have you got a pause button where I can? I don't understand the question. Is that, and then you don't book? Oh, you have already. Okay. So help me, give me a clue.
Graham. Which famous Grahams?
Right, well, Graham Souness spells his name differently from me and was a Liverpool legend, so I shouldn't be mentioning him in your podcast, but he's a tremendous football pundit and has been very kind to me in my journalistic life.
We once put a picture of a Mancunian tramp in United We Stand and put Graham Souness in the year 2000 ? When Souness was the manager of Liverpool, and we received a solicitor's letter a week later from a solicitor. The solicitor's letter wasn't from Mr. Souness, it was from the tramp solicitor. He'd got legal aid, and he said, as an avid Manchester United fan, you can understand that my client is distressed to be compared with the manager of Liverpool Football Club.
You're deranged, you're absolutely deranged. This last sort of 30 seconds has been like a mini episode of Shameless.
You can think of a Graham while I give you some more questions. Who would win a fight out of you, Sid Lowe or Guillaume Balague?
I think that all great champions show a little bit of grace, so I'm simply going to say, you know the answer to that question.
I do. Seamus Heaney, do you have any thoughts on the great man's work, is another question.
I would say that he's a loss because anybody of poetic talent and anybody who can lift the spirits is at a premium in this world. But he was a man for good and a man for peace, a man for vision, and he had a lyrical Celtic voice, and that's the kind of thing I aspire to.
Who's going to win the World Cup in Brazil? Graham wants to know. Another reader.
So that's a double. Who wants to know?
I'm not sure who it was. Remo, he's asked that question.
Okay, Remo. The feedback from Spain for the World Cup is that if they get drawn up in Fortaleza or Recife, the humidity in midsummer, paddling and some players who play too much football will be very taxing. There is no question Spain can still win it. If Vicente del Bosque introduces very important changes like Montoya or Carvajal to augment the right back position, if key players stay fit, if Xavi is used more sparingly within the tournament, if they can get David Villa back scoring goals and hopefully add a top class goal tally from Torres or Negredo or Soldado between now and the end of the season, if they can properly introduce Isco, get Thiago fit, find a proper place for Javi Martinez. It's a list of questions to be answered for Del Bosque, but if they start doing those things right and help my book sales by coming away from Helsinki, getting a decent result, then Spain are in a small group of maybe three, maximum four teams who can win it. I think that it would be really stupid. I was speaking to somebody at Sky last night who said Spain can't not win it. This is a guy who's put thousands on each of the last three major tournaments and won huge amounts because of it, and he is still convinced Spain can't lose the World Cup. I'm not convinced that's the case. And Brazil have got something which is very valuable at international level, which is they've given themselves a sort of club atmosphere. You know exactly what that means. It's what international managers strive for, and it means that where you've got players that you don't necessarily think are absolutely world class, whether it be Fred or Luis Gustavo or Hulk, they chip in with their lot. They give the momentum, the aggression, the pace, the athleticism that a squad of 16 needs in order to win a World Cup. I view Brazil, the travel, the cockroaches in Spain's room during the summer, rooms, the way in which the false story about why the players' rooms were robbed was bandied about. Brazil is a difficult place to go and win a World Cup. It would need an epic performance from Argentina, Germany or Spain, the only other teams I believe can win it, to go and beat Brazil in their own backyard. That's the group. And whichever team emerges from that group of potential winners, for me, so long as they play attractive, intelligent tournament football, and you won't hear me complaining if it happens not to be Spain.
If you go in, buy your Brazilian currency now because the Real has crashed in the last 6 weeks. But anyway, that's an aside. Next question. Are rumours of Messi being a total blank in training true?
Look, I can only bring to the table, like you could do, a knowledge of all dealings with Messi. This is a relatively ordinary, decent bloke with a world-class talent. In every in every football club where I managed to make inroads, there is a hierarchy. When people are not happy, they show it. There can be, let's take Rakina as an example. Was Rakina a particularly easy man to get along with on the training ground or the dressing room?
No.
No, he wasn't. Was he a phenomenal footballer and in the list of top 5, 6 United players ever? Yeah, probably, certainly in my view. Condescending, you and your listeners may say, I only think he's in the top 15.
I'd have him in the top three. I'd have him in the top three, Keane.
Well, I'd put the Messi. Messi is not really Keane, but when people listen to internet crap about this has happened, that's happened, the next happened, one, you want to apply a huge filter. Two, I think that the use of language in football analysis now, because it's available to everybody, has become very, very, very loose. And if Messi is demanding a little bit, hot-tempered, if he bitches and moans about things not done correctly, and it goes no further than that, then he'd have total support from me. Have the last couple of years, Barcelona have been exemplary in terms of their standards, their work rate off the pitch, in terms of their buying? No. And as such, if there has been a chippier, more demanding version of Leo Messi, then my admiration would go up, not down. A bully? No, I don't believe that. Is he still held in huge affection by the players who've known him all his life? Yes. Is anybody that's scared of him? I believe no. Could he, in his position, have an unhealthy influence on the club, on the team, and the coach? Yes, that's feasible. I totally accept that. Have we reached a critical point? No. There are a lot of people with ill agendas, saying things in the wrong way, and there are far greater problems for that football club to think about in terms of why they haven't signed at the back, how they manage change with aging footballers, how they replace Victor Valdes, why Victor Valdes has chosen to leave, and the president has his own questions off the pitch to answer. I've answered that question simply because, you know, your listener deserves to have the respect of an answer, but, you know, it pisses me off thoroughly. This is the kind of rubbish that, you know, that we have to endure. Not from your listener, but from the chattering classes who find rubbish to write about in the Catalan media or in the Madrid media or on Twitter. And it's a legitimate question for somebody who, you know, lives in England, listens to your podcast, to say, well, help us understand it. But you know yourself, Andy, there's a lot of crap out there.
I find it quite depressing as a journalist that stuff like that would be given a headline, whereas you can research a piece properly, you can find a really good story. And it might not lend itself to such a headline or a name as big as Messi, and it'll be buried away. I guess that's just the way of the media, and the people get the press which is from them. But I did a research piece into Girona a few weeks ago. Fascinating story, but it wouldn't get anything like the number of hits. And that's how some of the people who pay you and I measure the success, as a story, an inconsequential story about Messi. Anyway, final two questions. Do you have a good recipe for patatas bravas?
Yes. I'm not the front door. Go down my stairs. Turn left. enter local cafe. Sorted.
The final question. It's one I've asked most of our guests on here, but I've become scared of asking it because the last time I did, it was to Paddy Crerandon. I know Paddy well, as you know, and he had a real go at me. He wasn't happy, and the relationship is back on track. But the question is, and I also asked Tom Cleverley this, but I couldn't broadcast it, so I'll ask it to you anyway. Would you rather be bummed by a horse and nobody knew, or not bummed by a horse, and yet everybody thought you had been? Now, before you answer it, Henry Winter had a good minute's pause before answering it.
See, I didn't need the pause or the hooves, the latter.
You'd rather not be, but everybody thought you had been.
I think anybody who doesn't answer that is deranged. Number one, I have no need of that experience in my life. Number two, anybody who knows me and thinks I have doesn't know me particularly well, because I'd beat the horse and game and Sid. And I think finally as well, anybody who put that to me will find out all about it. So That's a no-brainer. I've been asked more difficult questions in my life.
Thank you for your time, Graham, and best wishes with your new Spain book. When does it come out?
Hold on a second.
Okay.
15th of November.
You're now
15th of November.
Okay. 15th of November. We'll run a review in United We Stand. We've now got a dedicated book reviewer, and so I will make sure that he gets a copy, and that will be in our December issue. Thank you for your time. Enjoy Manchester.
Manchester is wonderful. Enjoy your football, and may United give everybody thrills and happiness and inspiration this season. That's kind of what I think they stand for, as much as relentless trophies. I think we want to feel that Manchester United is a club that we can switch on television or buy our season tickets and say, well, that was worthwhile.
Pills, frills and bellyaches, that's Manchester United.
That'll do it.
So that's it for this episode of the United We Stand podcast. Join us next week when we'll be speaking with Quinton Fortune. He's got some really good tales, Quinton, about Africa, United, Madrid. We had a chat to record it in a restaurant in Manchester. The digital edition of United We Stand was a year old this week. Thanks to everybody who has subscribed and supported us and made our investment into a very expensive app worthwhile. We had a record month in August for people signing up and subscribing and reading the mag on whatever electronic device suits them. I'm still a print fan myself, still prefer print, but I accept that the world is changing and that we needed to offer a digital alternative. So thanks again to everybody who signed up for our website, uwsonline.com, to read the digital edition of the mag. Until next week, goodbye.